Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Mark Lobel, and in the early hours of Friday the 9th of August, these are our main stories. The Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has said he revoked Kashmir's autonomy to free it from terrorism and separatism. US immigration officials have released about half of nearly 700 people detained in a huge raid in the state of Mississippi. Campaigners say they should all be set free. Also in this podcast, a radiation scare in Russia after a rocket engine explosion kills two at a naval testing facility. And
Molotov cocktails against the wall of her home, rocks through her windows, and neo-Nazi graffiti on the side of her house.
We report on the rise of far-right extremism in Germany. The Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, has defended his government's decision to revoke the special status of Kashmir that allowed the region considerable autonomy, including a veto on who could own property there. He said its constitution bred terrorism, separatism and corruption.
Friends, after Article 370 and 35A and after the history that has passed, Jammu and Kashmir will come out and will make progress. And I have full faith in this. Friends and sisters, in this new growth, this government will have the wish that all citizens and workers will get all of the rights that have been implemented and practiced by other fellow countrymen.
But more than 500 people are reported to have been detained in Indian-administered Kashmir, where the internet and phone communications remain suspended. Here's a flavour of what Kashmiris were saying on the streets of Delhi on Thursday.
I don't think it's possible for any Kashmiri to reach out to his family. I don't have the privilege of knowing if they're alive or not. This is not integration, this is a betrayal.
If they're going to integrate us without our consent, that's not integration, that's occupation, isn't it? I fear for everyone in Kashmir.
Until today, there have been people who have believed in the idea of Indian democracy. They have left people who want to believe in the Indian democracy with very few straws to grab on.
Our correspondent in Delhi, Rahul Tandon, told me how Prime Minister Modi had justified his decision to revoke Indian-administered Kashmir's special status.
He spoke for 40 minutes in Hindi, and basically what he said was that Article 370, which had given Kashmir this special status, basically had not worked. He said it had led to nepotism, it had led to terrorism, and it had led to separatism. And he said it was time for a new era. What he was trying to promise the people of Indian-administered Kashmir was that basically his new policies were going to bring them employment. He talked about the great old days of Kashmir when every Bollywood movie used to be shot there. He said he was going to bring the film industry back. He was going to make it one of the tourism hubs. He also said, ironically, some Kashmiris may say, that he was going to improve connectivity at a time when many of them have no access to the internet, no access to phone lines, and have been cut off for 5 days. We're still not sure how many people would have been able to even watch or hear his speech.
Indeed, and an optimistic vision from him, but there's been a lot of international criticism, especially from the UN, saying these sudden restrictions imposed in Kashmir infringe human rights. And as we've been reporting, people have been detained. So what more do we know about who they are and how many there are?
We don't know enough, really, at this particular point in time, because the communication system, if you speak to many Kashmiris outside the state, they're calling it a siege at the moment. So it's so difficult to get information. It's coming out now in drips and drabs. We know that senior politicians, some of whom have even supported staying with India, have been put under house arrest, college professors, businessmen, but the true scale of what is going on, nobody knows. It's Eid on Sunday as well, the big Muslim festival. What's going to happen on that day? And of course, next week is Indian Independence Day. What Mr. Modi did not answer in his speech was why has he caused this clampdown on communications in the valley since he made his announcement, and how long is it going to last?
Rahul Tandon in Delhi. Shala Rashid is a politician with the Jammu and Kashmir People's Movement political party. The BBC asked her what she made of the Prime Minister's speech.
Claims that are being made of equality and how the Article 370 abrogation is being shown as a progressive measure, these fall flat, you know, on the face, because when we see the manner in which entire Kashmir has been placed under lockdown, people are not even involved in the decision making. They are not even aware that this decision has been taken. So actually something quite disastrous has happened. But we see that, you know, every time a disastrous decision is taken, after that, it is hailed as a very progressive decision. So actually, it feels like you're living in the Soviet Union, where all that we hear is government propaganda, really.
Is it for you the decision itself or the manner in which it has been enacted that is the most problematic thing?
We did not quite expect the decision itself, because that is unlawful and we are going to challenge it in the Supreme Court. But the manner in which it has been done, that is very, very shocking, and that negates our claims of being a democracy.
Although, as you say, you are fighting this in the courts, and that surely is a sign of democracy.
Yes, sure. I mean, let's see how the court treats us, because honestly, if we go by the Constitution, the court should give us relief, because what the government is trying to do is amend the basic structure of the Constitution of India. And that is something that is really problematic. I mean, you're carving out of a state, and then the state doesn't exist. Similarly, Article 370, which itself says that it cannot be amended, it's being used to amend itself. So it's almost as if the government is, you know, standing on a chair and trying to lift the chair.
Beyond your concerns about what this means for democracy in India, what else is it about this decision that leads you to call it a disaster?
This has created a sense of loss of identity among Kashmiris. They feel that the way that they have been downgraded from the status of a state to that of a union territory, this is like an attempt in colonization.
Well, Mr. Modi said that actually Kashmiris have had their own rights deprived because they haven't had the same rights as people in other parts of India. He cited, for example, workers in the sanitation sphere not having the same rights. He says this is actually going to increase the rights of Kashmiris.
All of his claims are bogus, because he, first of all, comes from a state where he has overseen a pogrom of minorities in his own tenure. Many scholars have pointed out that even in developmental indicators, the state of Gujarat, where Mr. Modi has been chief minister for 3 terms, even that fares very badly in comparison to the state of Jammu and Kashmir, where the development indicators are much better.
What about security, though? You can't deny that there has been a lot of terror in Kashmir.
That has nothing to do with 370. That has everything to do with the political history of Kashmir. It is going to make those problems even worse.
Do you think this will lead to more violence?
I hope not. But everything in history and logic tells us that it is going to increase. It is going to fuel the insurgency even more in an unprecedented manner.
Shala Rashid talking to James Kumarasamy. The Russian Defense Ministry has insisted there were no dangerous emissions released after an explosion at a naval testing facility in the far north of the country. Officials say they recorded a brief spike in radiation after the blast, which triggered automatic warnings for people to stay inside and close their windows. 2 people were killed in the blast and 6 injured. Sarah Rainsford sent this report from Moscow.
Russian state television announces another accident at a military facility, the second in a week. This time, a fatal explosion and fire when a rocket engine was being tested. The Defense Ministry gave very few details, but one line stood out. There were no dangerous emissions, its statement said. Radiation levels are normal. But in the nearby city of Severodvinsk, sensors had recorded a spike in background radiation for some 40 minutes around the time of the blast. It was enough to spark an alert. This official says residents were told to close their windows and stay home, children taken back inside kindergartens. Though he says there was no threat to health and the levels quickly dropped. The accident happened in Nyonoksa, a known test site for many kinds of missiles, including for Russia's atomic submarine fleet. The place made headlines a few years ago when a cruise missile misfired, its fragments hitting a nearby apartment block. Anxiety over this latest accident increased as it emerged that sections of the sea close to the site had been closed to shipping on orders from the military. It now seems that order came before the blast. It is, though, another major incident and embarrassment for the Russian military, after a fire on Monday at an ammunition store killed 1 person and forced the evacuation of 16,000 in western Siberia.
Sarah Rainsford reporting. It took the Kyrgyz security forces 2 raids on the home of the former president Almazbek Atambayev to get their man. On Wednesday, supporters of the former leader tried to block their way into the house near the capital, Bishkek, and succeeded. But on Thursday, after another attempt to get him by the special forces, Mr. Atambayev agreed to leave. All this because the former president is accused of corruption. He denies all charges, but was stripped of his parliamentary immunity in June. I asked Gulnara Kasmambet from the BBC's Kyrgyz service why Mr. Atambayev had agreed to be detained.
Because if he continued to resist, then his image would have fallen completely in the eyes of the entire country, because so far it were his supporters that were coming up and defending him, even aborting their own meeting that they planned for today. And they moved to the compound thinking, oh, there is a second raid starting now, we go and defend him there. And if he didn't agree, then the entire country would think, what is he trying to do? Is he trying to split the country so that citizens start clashing with each other? And in the last moment, he said, to avoid any bloodshed, I'm voluntarily giving myself in. And together with him, two aides also were detained, and they were taken to the Ministry of Internal Affairs.
What exactly is he accused of?
He's accused of releasing a criminal boss back in 2013, but it's not a direct accusation. He's been invited to court three times as a witness, which he refused to go. And he was even saying, if there's a need, I will take up arms to defend myself, which actually he did. One security officer died, and today, dramatically, he said, nobody had any firearms but me.
And explain to us how he's fallen out of favour with the current leadership. Is this politics playing out?
It is politics. It's all about Game of Thrones. The current president and the former presidents, they were allies. And Atambayev handpicked the current president, Sooronbay Jeenbekov. However, the new president realised if he wants to lead the country, then he can't be somebody's puppet. So he started moving to sidelines all the former president's allies, friends, or closest people. That's where the former president realized, actually, I put this person into his position, and now I'm being removed from my position of influencing him.
Do you think Mr. Atambayev is likely to be charged with anything?
Now, definitely will be charged, because one person already died, and he said that only he possesses the firearms.
Gulnara Kasmambet with parallels to Game of Thrones. You're listening to the Global News Podcast on the BBC World Service. Still to come, 50 years after a Beatles cover photo sparked conspiracy theories worldwide, fans are still flocking to that pedestrian crossing in London. President Trump's deportation policies are under fresh scrutiny after a man died just weeks after being deported by the US to Iraq. Although Jimmy al-Dawood was an Iraqi citizen, he'd never been there, couldn't speak Arabic, and was forced to live on the streets. Although his parents were from Iraq, he was born in Greece and had lived in Detroit since he was a baby. He also suffered from diabetes and paranoid schizophrenia, conditions which he was unlikely to receive treatment for after being deported. Alan Johnston reports.
Jimmy al-Dawood, who'd lived in America almost all his life, was filmed shortly before he died in Iraq. His deportation had plunged him into an alien world. He said he was homeless, living rough on the streets of Baghdad. With no Arabic, he couldn't communicate with those around him, and he was struggling to cope with a diabetic condition that required a supply of insulin. Mr. al-Dawood's U.S. congressman said he should never have been deported, that the order amounted to a death sentence. The American immigration authorities are yet to respond to the allegation.
Immigration officials in the U.S. are also facing questions about the arrest of almost 700 mainly Hispanic people in Mississippi. Some 300 have now been released. The people were rounded up for allegedly being without proper documentation. Some of their children returned home after school to find parents missing. Others were left in nurseries because there was no one to collect them. I asked our correspondent in the US, Chris Buckler, about the timing of this operation.
President Trump was on his way to El Paso in Texas whenever these raids were being carried out. And as you mentioned there, many of the people who were taken into custody by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents were Hispanic. And Democrats are pointing out that as he was going to meet the victims and the families of the victims of those in an attack which specifically targeted members of the Hispanic community, at the same time, members of his administration were targeting them. And as far as they were concerned, specifically trying to put them into a position where they would be deported from the United States. So at the moment, we have a list of Democratic presidential contenders all lining up, like Joe Biden, Beto O'Rourke and Bernie Sanders, saying some very incendiary things about President Trump as far as they're concerned. In one case, Bernie Sanders said that he believed the action was evil, given the timing.
The timing, of course, because of it being Hispanics. But parents were rounded up. What's happened to their children?
Yeah, and that is the other thing that has made this such a controversial series of raids. Because in many cases, these are parents, in some cases single parents, who were working while their children were actually going back to school. And some of them returned from school to their homes with nowhere to go to because their homes weren't there, their parents weren't there. And in fact, a gym had to be opened up to take those children. Clearly, there was a huge amount of upset. And here in the US, networks have been playing some clips from children in which they talk about their upset at their parents disappearing.
So I want my dad to be free and everybody else. A lot of children are crying because of their dad and mom missing.
Now, in response, we do have a statement from ICE, which is this group, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, in which they say that almost half of the people who were taken into custody have now been released. But as you can imagine, there is still a great deal of upset in the community.
Chris Buckler there. Chokwe Antar Lumumba is the mayor of Jackson, the Mississippi state capital. The BBC asked him what he made of these raids.
I think it is a gross display of a lack of humanity. Just listening to the audio of the young people expressing distress over what has taken place just reflects as a violation of human rights in the young person's mind, just understanding that her father was not a criminal, just a person seeking a better opportunity. And to say that, you know, this is an attack on those corporations who look to use this form of labor to get a competitive advantage. We've heard no mention of any criminal pursuit of those corporations, yet we think that it's okay to prosecute and criminalize the true victims of this circumstance.
Do you believe the corporations are the ones responsible?
First and foremost, I've become quite familiar with this circumstance, having represented MIRA prior to becoming the mayor, the Mississippi Immigrants Rights Alliance. I'm familiar that many people are solicited from their country of origin to come to Mississippi and other states within the United States for more opportunity, often giving up their life savings in order to do so, only to find a condition where they are held in an oppressive circumstance where these corporations take advantage of them.
It's wrong, it's illegal, and law enforcement agencies need to ensure that laws are followed, surely.
In terms of the exploitation of workers' rights, I would agree. In terms of criminalizing and arresting people and leaving their children to fend for themselves, I seem to remember laws in this state that were just as oppressive. Laws in this state where people were placed in shackles and cages because of their ethnic background. And we would not stand today and agree that those are justified laws. And so I staunchly oppose the laws as they exist. And I disagree with the sentiment that it should just be carried out because it is the law.
Chokwe Antar Lumumba talking to James Kumarasamy. Conservation groups in Venice have criticised government proposals to reroute cruise ships away from the city's historic centre as insufficient. Demands for action have grown in recent months following an accident in June in which a cruise ship collided with a dock, injuring five people. Here's our Italy correspondent, James Reynolds.
The landmarks which stand out in Venice include St Mark's Basilica, the Doge's Palace, and the outline of whichever cruise ship that happens to be passing through. Campaigners in Venice have long fought against the arrival of these towering vessels. They argue that the ships are dangerous and bad for both the local economy and the environment. They say that the Italian government's plan to begin diverting some ships away from the centre towards nearby ports within the lagoon is not good enough. Campaigners say that this will do little to stop the underwater erosion caused by the constant passage of giant ships. They want large vessels to be banned from the entire lagoon area. In the long term, the Italian government says that it plans to build a new terminal at a site which has yet to be agreed.
James Reynolds on why the Italian government is giving cruise ships a wide berth. In June, Walter Lübcke became the first German politician to be killed by the far right since the end of the Second World War. His support for refugees had turned him into a target in much the same way as the two mayors who've been stabbed and scores of local politicians who've been assaulted since large numbers of refugees and migrants arrived in Germany 4 years ago. But now the threat appears to be widening. In Berlin's southeastern district of Neukölln, local residents say that anyone critical of the far right is at risk, as Damien McGuinness reports.
Die haben ja quasi Molotow-Cocktails geworfen. Also das Schwarze, was man hier sieht, da war so ein Bitum drin.
Also das war ein Molotow-Cocktail.
Genau. Und da drüben
Molotow-Cocktails against the wall of her home, rocks through her windows, and neo-Nazi graffiti on the side of her house. For years, Christiane Schott has been targeted by right-wing extremists. It all started when she was doing some gardening at home. A group of men came into her front garden to put a leaflet in her letterbox. When she saw it was an election flyer for the German far-right party, the NPD, she said she didn't want that sort of material in her home. The men then threatened Christiane and told her that she would hear from them again. And she did.
Just because I said no to them, our whole life has been completely turned upside down. There were 7 attacks on my home, we've been threatened, we've had anonymous letters and phone calls.
So I've now come to the southern part of Neukölln. It's quite a residential area, and the man I'm about to meet is called Ferhat, and he is a local left-wing politician.
Hey, Ferhat. Hi, Damien.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
Thank you for coming out. So tell us what happened on that night.
I have met some friends here in this cafe, and afterwards I go out, and 2 far-right extremists, they observe me, and they follow me with a car to the house of my family, and 2 weeks later, they set my car on fire. And it was only a coincidence that I wake up in the night and can wake up my family and that we live now.
How about the impact on your family?
My mother got a heart attack 3 days after this attack. So it was very hard for us, yeah, to learn to deal with it.
Stefan Lux is one of the leaders of the NPD party in Berlin. He shows me his party's election campaign posters. On one of them, there are the words "migration kills." I put to him the allegations that far-right activists and indeed members of his party are threatening people and committing violence. He says nothing has been proven.
Man muss ja nur noch mal wissen, dass dieser beispielsweise Araber.
You have to understand that there are, for example, Arabs, Sunni Muslim Arabs, who are criminals, who act as part of criminal clans, who are competing with each other. In some of these cases, it can't be ruled out that people have been hit by criminal violence because of these competing gangs.
There is no evidence to support this theory, and police are treating the attacks as far-right crimes. I ask Ferhat why he thinks his neighbourhood is being targeted.
It's a very residential, traditionally white area of Neukölln.
But changing a lot, seeing lots of changes.
Yeah, it becomes more multicultural, and that's the reason why the far-right guys feel uncomfortable here.
There are plenty of other places that have been attacked in this part of Berlin, and it's become such a worry that residents have organised a tour. They call it a right-wing terror tour of Neukölln to find out what exactly the danger is and also discuss what they can do about it. One stop on the tour is this gallery that's run by Claudia. Now, she's a historian. She also stages exhibitions here about the Nazi era and the Second World War. She's also been targeted by right-wing extremist terror. The windows of Claudia's gallery have been smashed in and her car has also been torched. What do you want the authorities to do?
They should uncover why this right-wing terror is still being trivialised.
So far, no arrests have been made and the attacks continue. So once a week, Christiane comes here to police headquarters in Berlin. Together with other local residents, mostly older women, she stages a protest, calling for the police to do more to stop far-right violence. The intimidations continue, but Christiana is not backing down.
Damien McGuinness reporting. On Thursday, Beatles fans from around the world congregated on Abbey Road in London to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Beatles album cover being photographed. The image of John, Paul, George and Ringo on that pedestrian crossing sparked conspiracy theories, spawned recreations from the likes of The Simpsons, Doctor Who and even former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, and led to the pedestrian crossing being granted special protected status. Our entertainment correspondent Lizo Mazimba looks back at how one of the most iconic photographs of the 20th century was created.
They were the most famous band in the world, but even they may have underestimated the impact of those few minutes on the 8th of August 1969. The four members of the group walked out of the EMI studios, which were later renamed Abbey Road, and at 11:35 walked back and forth over the crossing. A police officer held up the traffic as photographer Ian McMillan took six quick shots from a stepladder. Paul McCartney chose the fifth for the album cover. It was also a shot in which he was barefoot. Speaking nearly 20 years later, McMillan said they didn't attract very much attention.
Paul was wearing his Oxfam suit and sandals in two of the shots, and then he took them off because it was a very hot day, and that's the reason for that. No mythology.
Abbey Road is regarded as particularly significant because it represents the last recording sessions that all four Beatles took part in together. And after the album was released, the crossing became an essential destination for Beatles fans visiting London. Here comes the sun, I say, it's all right. Hundreds were there for today's anniversary, many of them doing what fans have done for the last 50 years, walking over the crossing to create their own version of one of the best-known images in music history.
Music you can never tire of listening to, ending that report by Lizo Mazimba on a great moment there recreated at the expense of commuters and drivers as it created somewhat of a snarl-up on Abbey Road. It was all right, though, as the sun did indeed come out for them, despite the traffic. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Mark Lobel. Until next time, goodbye.